From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Many of the new photos show Lindy England and Charles Grainer having sex. But more disturbingly, the new photos and videos apparently reveal more torture, sexual humiliation and killings, seemingly perpetrated by soldiers at Abu Ghraib.
Today, an excerpt of the original Australian report that broke the story of more torture photos and videos at Abu Ghraib. We'll speak with the reporter Olivia Rousset of SBS Public Broadcasting in Sydney and Mark Benjamin of Salon.com, who release more photos in this country. Then Professor Alfred McCoy on a startling expose of the CIA development of psychological torture from the Cold War to Abu Ghraib.
When you look at those new photos that were released by SBS television, you can see CIA torture techniques that date back to the darkest days of the Cold War. The CIA has been engaged in torture for over 50 years.
The professor's CIA mercenaries attempted to assassinate more than 30 years ago. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A U.S. federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit filed by a Canadian citizen against the U.S. government for detaining him and sending him to Syria, where he was jailed and tortured. Maher Arar was the first person to mount a civil suit challenging the U.S. government policy known as extraordinary rendition. In October 2002, he was detained at JFK Airport while on a stopover in New York. He was then jailed and secretly deported to Syria, held for almost a year without charge in an underground cell not much larger than a grave. Charges were never filed against him. The federal judge, David Traeger, said he could not interfere in the case because it involves crucial national security and foreign relations issues. In Canada, Arar called the decision, quote, very disappointing and emotionally very hard to digest. Barbara Olshansky of the Center for Constitutional Rights said the law group will still try to proceed with the case. She said, quote, how can this administration argue before a federal court judge that its practice of outsourcing for interrogation under torture constitutes a state secret? This is a dark day indeed, she said. The United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is urging the United States to shut down Guantanamo prison camp, quote, as soon as is possible. His comments came in response to a new report by UN investigators calling for the U.S. to close the camp. Kofi Annan said the Bush administration could not hold hundreds of prisoners in jail without charge in perpetuity.
Charges have to be brought against them and be given a chance to explain themselves. And prosecuted, charged, or released, I think is something that is common under any legal system. And I think sooner or later there will be a need to close the Guantanamo. And I think it will be up to the government to decide and hopefully to do it as soon as is possible.
White House spokesperson Scott McClellan dismissed the new UN report.
You know, the United Nations should be making serious investigations across the world, and there are many instances in which they do when it comes to human rights. This was not one of them. And I think it's a discredit to the UN when a team like this goes about rushing to report something when they haven't even looked into the facts. All they have done is look at the allegations.
White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan. This update on the controversy over President Bush's warrantless domestic spying program. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans have blocked a proposed investigation into the spy operation. On Thursday, Republican Pat Roberts, chair of the Intelligence Committee, said his panel decided not to conduct an investigation. Roberts said he reached an agreement with the White House to consider legislation and provide more information to Congress on the eavesdropping program. The ranking Democrat on the committee, Senator John Rockefeller, said, quote, today the Senate Intelligence Committee once again abdicated its responsibility to oversee the intelligence activities of the United States. Meanwhile, a federal judge has ordered the Justice Department to release documents about the NSA program within 20 days. The order comes in response to a Freedom of Information request filed by EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. In other news from Capitol Hill, the Senate is moving closer to renewing the Patriot Act. Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin is leading the effort to block renewal, but he's receiving little support even from fellow Democrats. Feingold wants to set a four-year expiration date on provisions within the act that allows government agents to force banks, libraries, internet providers, and others to hand over private records without a warrant. On Thursday, the Senate voted 96-3 to reject Feingold's efforts to stall the legislation. Only independent Senator Jim Jeffords and Democrat Robert Byrd backed Feingold. Scientists announced Thursday Greenland's glaciers are melting into the sea twice as fast as previously believed. The shocking discovery has rendered obsolete predictions about how quickly the Earth's oceans will rise over the next century. The researchers found that in 2005, the glaciers discharged more than twice as much ice as they did in 1996. In news on Iran, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice called Tehran the, quote, central banker for global terrorism and accused it of working with Syria to destabilize the Middle East. Her comments came just a day after she announced the Bush administration seeking $75 million from Congress to step up its propaganda campaign against the Iranian government. Part of the funds will pay for the U.S. to begin around-the-clock broadcasts of Farsi-language TV and radio programs inside Iran. Meanwhile, France directly accused Iran Thursday of developing a secret nuclear military program. Iran maintains its nuclear program is for peaceful means. In Washington, several members of Congress are calling for an investigation into recent raids conducted by the FBI targeting pro-independence activists in Puerto Rico. Last week, hundreds of members of the FBI's counterterrorism unit conducted six simultaneous raids targeting members of the pro-independence group known as the Macheteros. The FBI claimed it was attempting to thwart a possible domestic terror attack. At one of the raids, FBI agents beat and pepper sprayed journalists who attempted to conduct interviews. The raids come less than 6 months after the FBI shot dead Puerto Rican independence leader Filiberto Ojeda Rios. And in Texas, authorities have closed the investigation into Vice President Dick Cheney's shooting accident without bringing any charges. On Saturday, Cheney shot his hunting partner, Harry Whittington. The 78-year-old Whittington remains hospitalized. Whittington was hit by shotgun pellets in the face, neck, and chest. Cheney and the White House have come under intense scrutiny for how it handled the shooting, in part because the press wasn't notified for nearly a day. Cheney didn't make any public comment till Wednesday when he sat down for an interview with Fox News. On Thursday, President Bush discussed the shooting publicly for the first time.
I thought the vice president handled the issue just fine. He went through, and I thought his explanation yesterday was a powerful explanation. Now, this is a man who likes the outdoors and he likes to hunt. And he heard a bird flush and he turned and pulled the trigger and saw his friend get wounded. And it was a deeply traumatic moment for him and obviously for the, it's a tragic moment for Harry Whittington. And so I thought his explanation yesterday was a very strong and powerful explanation. And I'm satisfied with the explanation he gave.
President Bush speaking Thursday. And in the Philippines, many are feared dead after a major landslide buried an entire village in the central part of the country. 16 people have been confirmed dead so far. But the Red Cross and military said between 1,500 and 2,500 villagers might be buried in the mud. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The release of more photographs of atrocities committed by American soldiers against Iraqi detainees in the U.S.-run Abu Ghraib prison have spread outrage across Iraq. An official in Prime Minister Ibrahim Jaafari's office said, quote, "The serious affair totally contradicts human rights and should not be repeated." The Australian news program Dateline aired a report earlier this week that showed new photographs of Iraqi detainees being tortured inside Abu Ghraib. The photographs are graphic, showing, among other images, a dead man lying in the dirt with blood coming out of his head, another prisoner covered in feces, and others in sexually humiliating positions. The U.S. government quickly condemned the release of the new photographs. Pentagon spokesperson Brian Whitman said the photos will only inflame and incite unnecessary violence and will endanger the U.S. military. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said yesterday the photos are nothing new and that the perpetrators have already been punished.
Congressman Murtha, I'm told that these photographs that are coming out now are nothing more than the same things that came out before, if not identical, of the same type of behavior. That behavior has been punished. The Department of Defense, from the beginning of this conflict, has had a policy that prohibits torture. It has not permitted it. We do not today. The people are trained to avoid it, and there's no question but that there was conduct that was improper, and people were court-martialed, and people have been sent to prison, and people have been reduced dramatically in rank, officers have, and punished for the behavior that was unacceptable.
So far, no high-ranking officer or official has been charged in the abuse scandal. Meanwhile, State Department legal advisor John Bellinger criticized the release of the photos.
These additional photographs that are now out are disgusting and shows once again just the reprehensible conduct that was going on in Abu Ghraib. It's unfortunate, though, that the photographs are continuing to come out because I think it simply fans the flames at a time that sentiments on these issues are raw around the world.
In Australia, Dateline's executive producer Mike Carey spoke out defending his program's decision to air the photos.
Well, it seems to us that there is a quantum leap in the abuse, in the potential abuse. Corpses, really despicable sexual humiliation. As far as I understand, these have not been investigated. And that's why we felt, as I say, a responsibility to broadcast them, to bring them out. It's a freedom of speech issue, really, to bring them out into the open and to see what happens from there.
In a moment, we'll go to the reporter who broke the story. But we go now to an excerpt of the report that aired on the Australian news program Dateline. For the TV viewers of Democracy Now!, please be warned. These images are extremely violent and graphic in nature.
Many of the new photos show Lindy England and Charles Grainer having sex. But more disturbingly, the new photos and videos apparently reveal more torture, sexual humiliation and killings seemingly perpetrated by soldiers at Abu Ghraib. This video shows naked men apparently forced to masturbate in front of the soldiers and their camera. Based on the American Army's own inquiry, we can reveal the following details of the new photographs and videos. This man, listed as Detainee 10, is thought to be an Iraqi general who was resisting relocation from the outside camp to the cell blocks, known as the hard site at Abu Ghraib. The report states that he was pushed against a wall, at which point guards noticed blood coming from underneath his hood. The 1.5-inch cut on his chin was sutured by a medic. While an army report lists a description of this photo as detainee apparently shot by MP personnel with shotgun using less than lethal rounds, the circumstances surrounding the incident are unknown. An American soldier told me that this man was first held in the camp outside the hard site at Abu Ghraib, and that after causing problems with the other detainees, he was brought into the cells where the high-value prisoners were kept. Known to the soldiers as Shit Boy, due to an alleged habit of covering himself in his own feces, he was left without psychiatric care. He apparently became a plaything of the guards, who experimented with ways to restrain him. He's filmed here from several different angles, handcuffed to a cell, slamming his head into the metal door. The soldiers chose to film him several times from different angles, rather than try to prevent his self-harm. An American soldier who worked as a guard at Abu Ghraib told me these two women were arrested for working as prostitutes and were held in Abu Ghraib for 48 hours.
Government documents we have show that the overwhelming majority of detainees held in Abu Ghraib were in all likelihood innocent.
Amrit Singh, a lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union, from an excerpt of the Australian Dateline report showing new photographs of torture at Abu Ghraib, narrated by reporter Olivia Rousset. The Dateline report will air in its entirety for the first time on American television on Link TV tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 Pacific. Link's program, Abu Ghraib, the sequel, will also include Middle Eastern reaction to the photos and video. Link TV will also air Lifting the Hood, 5 hours of special programming, examine the U.S. use of torture, rendition, and extra-legal methods to fight the so-called war on terror. That program will be airing on February 23rd at 7 Eastern, 4 Pacific. Olivia Rousset, the Australian reporter who broke the story, now joins us on the line from Sydney. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about how you got these photos and video that have not been seen yet by the public until now?
I've been for some time sort of looking into Abu Ghraib and what happened there. Last year I spoke to some of the victims of torture who were in the previously leaked photographs, and at the moment I'm working on a story about the guards, and came across the new or the previously unreleased photographs when I was doing that.
Can you talk about what's new here? Exactly what you have seen and gotten your hands on?
Well, look, the disc itself contains over 1,000 images, actually, you know, more than 6,000, but a lot of them are repeated. What I used in the story was a pretty wide representation of the kind of material on there. Obviously, a lot of it is the same as what was released before. It's from the same series of events, the same torture and abuse, but there are new cases of abuse that haven't been seen before, and some corpses of people who have been either killed in riots or killed from mortars going over the wall into the prison. But it to me it sort of shows that there was pretty widespread abuse going on.
And your response to U.S. authorities, who said that the release of these images endangers U.S. soldiers around the world?
I think the abuses themselves endanger U.S. soldiers around the world. My experience from talking to Iraqis has been that they all know this happened. They all knew this was going on way before any of us did. It's nothing new to them. It's a long time. The truth and the full story is a long time coming for everyone else, but these are people who have been living with it and who aren't surprised by it. They're possibly more surprised by the reaction of the rest of the world or lack of reaction at different times.
Can you talk about the photos you have of the Iraqi, I believe he was a general, who we did know was killed, but you have additional photographs?
I'm not sure if you're talking to the same person. There was the guy I referred to in the story as a general was the one who was cut under his chin. But none of the corpses that I know of in the photographs were generals. But,
well, I also want to bring in Olivia Rousset, another reporter who is adding more photographs now in this country. On Thursday, a day after your report, the Australian report aired, Salon.com published more torture photographs from Abu Ghraib. The online publication obtained photos, video, and other electronic documents from an internal army investigation. The article accompanying the photos stated the source who gave the materials to Salon is, quote, someone who spent spent time at Abu Ghraib, is a uniformed member of the military, and is familiar with the investigation. The article goes on to say the material includes, quote, a total of 1,325 images of suspected detainee abuse, 93 video files of suspected detainee abuse, 660 images of adult pornography, 546 images of suspected dead Iraqi detainees, 29 images of soldiers in simulated sexual acts, 20 images of a soldier with a swastika drawn between his eyes, 37 images of military working dogs being used in abusive detainees, and 125 images of questionable acts. Mark Benjamin joins us in the studio now, the reporter who obtained these photos for Salon.com. As we speak with Olivia Rousset, Mark Benjamin, talk about what you have released.
Well, what we have tried to do at Salon is to release images that no one has seen, in addition to the Australian television production. So we believe that the images that ran with our article have not been seen by anyone, and also depict images of abuse that no one has seen before.
Are these pictures overlapping with what Olivia Rousset has released on Dateline?
I believe that what Salon has in our possession is what has been published by every news organization so far, including the Australian television production, and then some additional photos. In other words, it looks like our files, which come from an internal Army investigation, sort of had the full Monty, so to speak.
And explain one more time, this internal Army investigation, who conducted it?
The Army's Criminal Investigation Command, it's sort of their internal investigation unit, conducted a look at the photos specifically and the people in the photos. A lot of the materials are from the summer of 2004 when the story broke. It's called CID, the Army's CID unit is looking at those photos. The investigation shows them developing a timeline, looking at the stamps on the photos, the electronic stamps on the photos, to figure out when they were taken, to try to identify the detainees who were being abused and identify the specific soldiers who were carrying out the abuse. I would note, while there have been some broader Army investigations, which have been controversial, to look at the chain of command, this investigation does not look at the chain of command at all. It appears to be solely focused at who those soldiers are that are in the pictures carrying out the abuse.
We have to break, and when we come back, we'll continue with Mark Benjamin of Salon.com and Olivia Rousset of SBS Dateline in Australia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk to Olivia Rousset of SBS Dateline in Australia and Mark Benjamin, a reporter who's been covering soldiers in Iraq and back from Iraq, especially many of the wounded, the tens of thousands. Mark Benjamin works for Salon.com. I want to ask you the same question I asked Olivia, Mark, and that is your response to the U.S. government, the State Department, condemning the release of these photographs.
Just add that argument has already been rejected by a federal judge who said, you know, release of photographs doesn't, terrorists need no pretext to carry out their terrorist acts. So I think that argument has been rejected. And I agree that, if the Army is so concerned about images of torture or abuse inciting violence, one thing to do is to try to prevent it in the first place. I would also note that this one of the reasons why we're conducting this investigation at Ceylon is because there are some indications that would suggest that the responsibility for this abuse may go relatively high in the chain of command. For example, the military intelligence folks, who are the professional interrogators, are heavily involved in directing operations at Abu Ghraib, according to the materials that we have. The materials also show heavy involvement by OGA, other government agency, which is a code word for CIA folks. The involvement of those people at the prison suggests the possibility that this was a more organized abuse situation. And until we've gotten to the bottom of that, we're going to continue to investigate. And if in the process of that we come across photos that we believe should be part of the public record, we are going to publish them.
Olivia Rousset, images of CIA involvement?
Look, from what I think Ceylon have had more printed material that sort of describe the photos more. What I've got, I think, is the same photographs without the backup. There seems to be that, and I think it's pretty clear. It's a bit more guarded in the US, it seems, when people talk about this, but it seems to me to be a bit of a given here anyway in people's knowledge of what happened there, that absolutely MPs were under military intelligence command and orders, and that CIA were involved, for instance, in the death of Munadel al-Jumaili, the corpse that appeared in the first leaked photographs and now in further ones. He died under CIA interrogation. So.
Yes, that's the image I was referring to before.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. He wasn't a general,
yes,
though. But he, you know, it's. I think all of that's pretty clear, and it's good that this stuff comes out, because anything else, it sort of forces people to actually acknowledge that instead of somehow not stating the obvious truth. I don't know.
Olivia, the response in Australia, which was the Australian government supporting Bush in the invasion.
Sorry, Amy, what was
the response in Australia to these images, the government supporting President Bush in the invasion?
The response here has been interesting. It's sort of, you know, like most places in the world, there were great marches, and the people were mainly against the invasion of Iraq, but we went, and opinion sort of shifted both ways. It's interesting here, people have been a lot quieter about the release of these photographs, as far as I can tell anyway. Obviously, it plays out a lot more in the US, but I think there's a lot of fear that people have about this. About a lot of people have been talking about the cartoons, and I can't see the parallel at all, but they're making the link.
Finally, Mark Benjamin, the person you got this cache of photos and videos from, how close to the investigation, and because you work with soldiers so much, the response of U.S. military soldiers?
Well, I'm not going to talk at all about the source who gave me the materials from the Army. I do also, separately, I do know some lower-level soldiers who served at Abu Ghraib, and I would say that they are... I would say some of them are furious because they believe very strongly that the abuse is there. And some of this has come out in the trial of the trials of the lower-level enlisted folks who have been put in prison over this. They believe very strongly that the abuses that occurred at Abu Ghraib were a result of the actions of the higher echelons in the Army, in other words, the Army brass and perhaps higher. And they are furious and angry because they believe that those higher-ups who should bear some responsibility have not been brought to justice.
How high up?
They don't know. I mean, in other words, what they know is that military intelligence appears to have been telling them what to do, or they say they were. They know that the CIA was there running the show in some cases. And there are also some soldiers who have said publicly that when they tried to tell very high-level people what was going on, they were told to shut up. And that has made some of those soldiers very, very angry, and has increased their belief that what is going on here goes high. I think that's one of the reasons why we're working so hard on the story. We're trying to figure out just how high it goes.
I want to thank you, Mark Benjamin of Ceylon.com, and Olivia Rousset of SBS Dateline for joining us. And again, Link TV, which is on DirecTV Channel 375 and Dish Network Channel 9410, will have the exclusive broadcast of the whole SBS Dateline report tonight at 7 Pacific, 4 Eastern Standard Time, the network that Democracy Now! Also broadcasts on. And you are listening to and watching Democracy Now!, the images that we have been talking about are on our website at democracynow.org. As we turn now to take a look at what lies behind the shocking images of torture at Abu Ghraib, by turning to the history of the CIA and torture techniques, the International Committee of the Red Cross, Amnesty International, and other human rights groups say the recently released images of abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib show a clear violation of international humanitarian law. The U.S. made a pledge against torture when Congress ratified the U.N. Convention Against Torture in 1994, but it was ratified with reservations that exempted the CIA's psychological torture method. So what were the results? A new exposé gives an account of the CIA's secret efforts to develop new forms of torture spanning half a century. It reveals how the CIA perfected its methods, distributing them across the world from Vietnam to Iran to Central America, uncovering the roots of the Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo torture scandals. The book is called A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. And we're joined by its author, Alfred McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
And glad to have you with us, especially in light of your history. I first learned of you with your first book, The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade, for which you almost died. What happened then?
Oh, when I was researching that book in the mountains of Laos, hiking from village to village, interviewing Laotian farmers about their opium harvest, and they were telling me that they took it down to the local helicopter pad where Air America helicopters would land, Air America being a subsidiary of the CIA, and officers, tribal officers in the CIA secret army would buy the opium and fly it off to the CIA secret compound where it would be transformed into heroin and ultimately wound up in South Vietnam. And while I was doing that research, hiking from village to village, interviewing farmers, we were ambushed by a group of CIA mercenaries. Fortunately, I had five militiamen from the village with me, and we shot our way out of there, but they came quite close. And later on, a CIA operative threatened to murder my interpreter unless I stopped doing that research. And then when the
book... How did you know they were CIA?
Oh, look, in the mountains of Laos, there aren't that many white guys. Okay, I mean, the mercenaries, first of all, the CIA ran what was called the Army Clandestine. They had a secret army, and those soldiers that ambushed us were soldiers in the secret army. That we knew.
The Laotian army.
The CIA secret army.
The okay? Laotian mercenaries.
Laotian mercenaries. That everybody's clear about that. Nobody denied that. They said it was sort of an accident, but no, it was very clear that it was intentional. And ultimately, when the book was in press, the head of covert operations for the CIA called at my offices and my publisher in New York and insisted that the publisher suppress the book. They then got the right to prior review. The publisher compromised.
CIA prior review.
Prior review of the manuscript. And they issued a 14-page critique. The publisher's legal department, HarperCollins' legal department, reviewed the critique, reviewed the manuscript, published the book unchanged, not a word changed.
And the contention of that book was that the CIA was complicit in the global drug trade?
Right. In the context of conducting covert operations around the globe, particularly in the Asian opium zone, which stretched from the Golden Triangle of Vietnam and Laos all the way to Afghanistan, that in those mountains far away from home, when the CIA had to mobilize tribal armies, the only allies were warlords, and when the CIA formed an alliance with them, the warlords used this alliance to become drug lords, and the CIA didn't stop them from their involvement in the traffic.
Well, as a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, you have not stopped looking at the CIA, and now you've written this new book. It's called A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. Give us a history lesson.
Well, if you look at that most famous of photographs from Abu Ghraib, of the Iraqi standing on the box, arms extended, with a hood over his head, and the fake electrical wires from his arms, okay? In that photograph, you can see the entire 50-year history of CIA torture. It's very simple. He's hooded for sensory disorientation, and his arms are extended for self-inflicted pain. And those are the two very simple, fundamental CIA techniques developed at enormous cost. From 1950 to 1962, the CIA ran a massive research project, a veritable Manhattan Project of the mind, spending over $1 billion a year to crack the code of human consciousness from both mass persuasion and the use of coercion in individual interrogation. And what they discovered, they tried LSD, they tried mescaline, they tried all kinds of drugs, they tried electroshock, truth serum, sodium pentothal, none of it worked. What worked was very simple behavioral findings outsourced to our leading universities, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, McGill. And the first breakthrough came at McGill, and it's in the book right here, and you can see if you want to show it, you can. That graphic really shows that's the seminal CIA experiment done in Canada at McGill University.
Describe it.
Oh, it's very simple. Dr. Donald O'Hebb of McGill University, a brilliant psychologist, had a contract from the Canadian Defense Research Board, which was a partner with the CIA in this research. And he found that he could induce a state of psychosis in an individual within 48 hours. It didn't take electroshock, truth serum, beating, or pain. All he did was had student volunteers sit in a cubicle with goggles, gloves, and headphones, earmuffs, so that they were cut off from their senses. And within 48 hours, denied sensory stimulation, they would suffer first hallucinations, then ultimately breakdown. And if you look at many of those photographs, what do they show? They show people with bags over their head. If you look at the photographs of the Guantanamo detainees even today, they look exactly like those student volunteers in Dr. Hebb's original cubicle. Now, then the second major breakthrough that the CIA had came here in New York City at Cornell University Medical Center, where two eminent neurologists under contract from the CIA studied Soviet KGB torture techniques, and they found that the most effective KGB technique was self-inflicted pain. You simply make somebody stand for a day or two, and as they stand, okay, you're not beating them, they have no resentment, you tell them, you're doing this to yourself, cooperate with us and you can sit down. And so as they stand, what happens is the fluids flow down to the legs swell, lesions form, they erupt, they separate, hallucinations start, the kidneys shut down. Now if you look at the other aspect of those photos, you'll see that they're short shackled, okay, that they're long shackled, that they're made, several of those photos you just showed, one of them with a man with a bag on his arm. His arms are straight in front of him. People are standing with their arms extended. That's self-inflicted pain. And the combination of those two techniques, sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain, is the basis of the CIA's technique.
Who has pioneered this at the CIA?
This was done by Technical Services Division. Most of the in-house research involved drugs and all the LSD experiments that we've heard about for years. But ultimately, they were a negative result. When you have any large, massive research project, you hit dead ends, you hit brick walls, you get negative results. All the drugs didn't work. What did work was this.
But when you talk about everyone knows the LSD experiments. I don't think everyone knows. In fact, I would conjecture that more than 90% of Americans don't know that the CIA was involved with LSD experiments on unwitting Americans. Can you explain what they did?
Oh, sure. As a part of this comprehensive survey of human consciousness, the CIA tried every possible techniques. And one of the things that they, at the time that this research started in the late 1940s, a Swiss pharmaceutical company developed LSD.
Which one?
I forget now. One of the major Swiss pharmaceutical companies. Dr. Hoffman there was the man who developed it. The CIA bought substantial doses, and they conducted experiments. One of the most notorious experiments was that Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, inside the agency, spiked the drinks of his co-workers. One of those co-workers suffered a breakdown, Dr. Frank Olson, and he was pushed or he jumped from a hotel here in New York City.
His son has never stopped pursuing this case.
His son, Eric Olson, insists that his father was murdered by the CIA. Eric Olson believes that his father did a tour of Europe, and he visited the ultimate Anglo-American test site, Black Site, near Frankfurt, where they were doing lethal experiments, fatal experiments on double agents and suspected double agents, and that his father returned enormously upset by the discovery that this research was actually killing people, and that therefore Eric Olson argues his father was killed by the CIA, that he was pushed.
And didn't they do experiments in brothels in the San Francisco area?
They had two kind of party houses. They had one in the San Francisco Bay Area and another in New York City. And what they did in San Francisco was they had prostitutes would go out to the streets, get individuals, bring them back, give them a drink, and there would be a two-way mirror, and the CIA would photograph these people.
What so the CIA was running the brothel?
They're running the brothel. They're running all these experiments, okay? They did that on Army soldiers through the Army Chemical Warfare Division.
What did they do there?
Again, they gave them LSD and other drugs to see what effect they would have.
And what did the soldiers think they were getting?
They were just told they were participating in an experiment for national defense.
Prisoners?
No, these were
right, but also on prisoners.
There were some in prisons in the United States, and also the Drug Treatment Center in Lexington, Kentucky. The Federal Drug Treatment Center in Lexington, Kentucky had this. Now, all this very elaborate research. Unwitting Americans produced nothing. Okay, what they found time and time again is that electroshock didn't work, sodium pentothal didn't work, LSD certainly didn't work. You scrambled the brain, you got unreliable information. But what did work was the combination of these two rather boring, rather mundane behavioral techniques, sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain. And in 1963, the CIA codified these results in the so-called QBARC Counterintelligence Manual. And if you just type the word QBARC, K-U-B-A-R-K, into Google, you'll get the manual, an actual copy of it on your computer screen. And you can read the techniques. But if you do, read the footnotes, because that's where the behavioral research is. Now, this produced a distinctively American form of torture, the first real revolution in the cruel science of pain in centuries, psychological torture. And it's the one that's with us today. And it's proved to be a very resilient, quite adaptable and enormously destructive paradigm. Let's make one thing clear. Americans refer to this oftentimes in common parlance as torture light. Psychological torture, people who are involved in treatment tell us, is far more destructive, does far more lasting damage to the human psyche than does physical torture. As Senator McCain said himself last year when he was debating his torture prohibition, faced with the choice between being beaten and psychologically tortured, I'd rather be beaten. Okay, it does far more lasting damage. It's far crueler than physical torture. This is something we don't realize in this country. Now, another thing we see in those photographs is the psychological techniques. Look, the initial research basically developed techniques for attacking universal human sensory receptors: sight, sound, heat, cold, sense of time. That's why all the detainees describe being put in dark rooms, being subjected to strobe lights, loud music. That's sensory deprivation or sensory assault. Okay, that was sort of the phase one of the CIA research. But the paradigm has proved to be quite adaptable. Now, one of the things that Donald Rumsfeld did right at the start of the War of Terror, in late 2002, he appointed General Jeffrey Miller to be chief at Guantanamo, all right, because the previous commanders at Guantanamo were too soft in the detainees. And General Miller turned Guantanamo into a de facto behavioral research laboratory, a kind of torture research laboratory. And under General Miller at Guantanamo, they perfected the CIA torture paradigm. They added two key techniques. They went beyond the universal sensory receptors of the original research. They added to it an attack on cultural sensitivity, particularly Arab male sensitivity to issues of gender and sexual identity. And then they went further still. Under General Miller, they created these things called biscuit teams, behavioral science consultation teams. And they actually had qualified military psychologists participating in the ongoing interrogation. And these psychologists would identify individual phobias like fear of dark or attachment to mother. And by the time we're done, by 2003, under General Miller, Guantanamo had perfected the CIA paradigm. And it had a threefold total assault on the human psyche: sensory receptors, self-inflicted pain, cultural sensitivity, and individual fears and phobia.
And then they sent General Miller to, quote, Gitmoize Abu Ghraib. Professor McCoy, we're going to break for a minute, and then we'll come back. Professor Alfred McCoy, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His latest book is called A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. Stay with us. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are talking to Alfred Mackay, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, author of a number of books, The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade, almost had him killed. Afterwards, the CIA tried to have the book squelched, but ultimately it was published. Then, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror is his latest book, and we're talking about the history of torture. Continue with what you were saying, talking about the biscuit teams, the use of psychologists in Guantanamo, and then Jeffrey Miller going from Guantanamo to, quote, Gitmoize Abu Ghraib.
In mid-2003, when the Iraqi resistance erupted, the United States found it had no intelligence assets. It had no way to contain the insurgency. And the U.S. military was in a state of panic. And at that moment, they began sweeping across Iraq, rounding up thousands of Iraqi suspects, putting many of them in Abu Ghraib prison. At that point, in late August 2003, General Miller was sent from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib, and he brought his techniques with him. He brought a CD, and he brought a manual of his techniques. He gave them to the MP officers, the military intelligence officers, and to General Ricardo Sanchez, U.S. commander in Iraq. In September of 2003, General Sanchez issued orders, detailed orders, for expanded interrogation techniques beyond those allowed in the U.S. Army Field Manual 3452. And if you look at those techniques, what he's ordering, in a sense, essence, is a combination of self-inflicted pain, stress positions, and sensory disorientation. If you look at the 1963 CIA Kubark Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual, you look at the 1983 CIA Interrogation Training Manual that they use in Honduras for training Honduran officers in torture and interrogation. And then 20 years later, you look at General Sanchez's 2003 orders. There's a striking continuity across this 40-year span in both the general principles, this total assault on the existential platforms of human identity and existence, okay, and the specific techniques, the way of achieving that, through the attack on these sensory receptors.
And Rumsfeld's comment, when asked if it was torture when people were forced to stand hours on end, that he stands at his desk.
Right. He wrote that in one of his memos. When he was asked to review the Guantanamo techniques in late 2003, early 2004, he scribbled that marginal note and said, you know, I stand at my desk 8 hours a day. He has a designer standing desk. How come we're limiting these techniques of the stress position to just 4 hours, okay? So, in other words, that was a clear signal from the defense secretary. Now, one of the problems beyond the details of these orders is torture is an extraordinarily dangerous thing. There's an absolute ban on torture for a very good reason. Torture taps into the deepest recesses, unexplored recesses of human consciousness, where creation and destruction coexist, where the infinite capacity, human capacity for kindness, and infinite human capacity for cruelty coexist. And it has a powerful, perverse appeal. And once it starts, both the perpetrators and the powerful who order them, let it spread, and it spreads out of control. So I think when the Bush administration gave those orders for basically techniques tantamount to torture at the start of the war on terror, I think it was probably their intention that these be limited to top al-Qaeda suspects. But within months, we were torturing hundreds of Afghanis at Bagram near Kabul, and a few months later, in 2003, through these techniques, we were torturing literally thousands of Iraqis. And you can see in those photos, beyond the details of the techniques that we've described, you can see how that once it starts, it becomes this Dantesque hell, this kind of play palace of the darkest recesses of human consciousness. That's why it's necessary to maintain an absolute prohibition on torture. There is no such thing as a little bit of torture. The whole myth of scientific surgical torture that torture advocates, academic advocates in this country came up with, that's impossible. That cannot operate. It will inevitably spread.
So when, Professor Mackay, you started seeing these images, the first photos that came out at Abu Ghraib, the pictures we showed of the hooded man, electrodes coming out of his fingers, standing on the box, your response?
Oh, I mean, when I the reason I wrote this book is when that photo came out in April 2004 on CBS News. At the time, William Safire, for example, writing the New York Times, said this was the work of creeps. Later on, ex-Defense Secretary Schlesinger said this was just abuse by a few people on the night shift. There was another phrase, recycled hillbillies from Cumberland, Maryland. In other words, this was the bad apple thesis. We could blame these bad apples. I looked at those photos. I didn't see individual abuse. What I saw was two textbook, trademark CIA psychological interrogation techniques, okay? Self-inflicted pain and sensory disorientation.
We read our first headline today. It was about Maher Arar and the case. The judge has thrown it out against him, the Canadian-Syrian man who was sent back to Syria. The U.S. government calls it extraordinary rendition. And he was kept in an underground grave-like cell, he described, very small. He was held for almost a year. As you showed, and I looked at the book, the pictures of the places where prisoners are kept. And in speaking to Maher, he's described this level of sensory deprivation. What about the shape and the size and the coffin-like nature of these rooms?
The details are often left to the individual interrogators, but the manuals basically describe how you control the process, you control the environment right from the start when you pick somebody up. So, for example, oftentimes we see in Iraq of people when they're arrested, their arms are behind their back, they're made to kneel in very uncomfortable positions, and they're hooded right away. That's one of the things they always specify is the time and conditions of arrest. You begin to break them down. You create this artificial environment of control. And then the techniques always vary. It can be extreme darkness, or it can be extreme light. It can be absence of sound, or a bombardment of sound.
And that bombardment of sound is often joked about. We played Britney Spears really loud, or whatever it is. I don't know if it was her. But that's become a joke when soldiers play loud music.
Right. Well, though, actually, that's one of the problems of talking about this topic in the United States, is that we regard all of this panoply of psychological techniques as torture light, as somehow not really torture, okay? And we're the only country in the world that does that. The UN Convention defines torture as the infliction of severe psychological or physical pain. The UN Convention, which bans torture in 1984, gives equal weight to psychological and physical techniques, okay? We alone, as a society, somehow exempt all these psychological techniques. That dates back, of course, to the way that we ratified the convention in the first place. Back in the early 1990s, when the United States was emerging from the Cold War, and we began this process of, if you will, disarming ourselves and getting beyond all these techniques, trying to sort of bring ourselves in line with the rest of the international community. When President Clinton sent the UN Anti-Torture Convention to the U.S. Congress for ratification in 1994, he included four detailed paragraphs of reservation that had, in fact, been drafted by the Reagan administration, and he adopted them without so much as changing a semicolon. And when you read those detailed paragraphs of reservation, what you realize is this, is that the United States Congress ratified the treaty, but basically we outlawed only physical torture. Those paragraphs of reservation are carefully written to avoid one word in the 26 printed pages of the UN Convention. That word is mental. Basically, we exempted psychological torture. Now, another problem for the United States was, as well, is when the U.S. Army rewrote the Army Field Manual in 1992, the same period, let's say, the civil authorities were sort of skirting the law by exempting psychological techniques, the U.S. Army rewrote their field manual with the intention of strictly observing the letter and the spirit of the UN Anti-Torture Convention and other similar treaties. So what happened is when the Defense Department gave orders for extreme techniques, when General Sanchez gave orders for his techniques beyond the Army field manual, what that meant is when the soldiers were actually investigated, they had committed crimes under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. They would be prosecuted, and they were all being sent to jail.
Professor McCoy, you wrote a piece, Why the McCain Torture Ban Won't Work, the Bush Legacy of Legalized Torture.
Right. Most Americans think that it's over, that in last year, December 2005, the U.S. Congress passed the Detainee Treatment Act 2005, which, in the language of Senator McCain, who was the original author of that amendment to the Defense Appropriation, the author of that act, it bars all inhumane or cruel treatment. And most people think that's it, that it's over, okay? Actually, what's happened is the Bush administration fought that amendment tooth and nail. They fought it with loopholes. Vice President Cheney went to Senator McCain and asked for a specific exemption for the CIA. McCain refused. The National Security Advisor went to McCain and asked for certain kinds of exemptions for the CIA. He refused. So then they started amending it. And basically what happened is through the process, they introduced loopholes. Look, at the start of the war on terror, the Bush administration ordered torture. President Bush said right on September 11, 2001, when he addressed the nation, "I don't care what the international lawyers say, we're going to kick some ass." Those were his words. And then it was up to his legal advisors in the White House and the Justice Department to translate his otherwise unlawful orders into legal directives. And they did it by crafting three very controversial legal principles. One, that the president as commander-in-chief could override laws and treaties. Two, that there was a possible defense for CIA interrogators who engage in torture. And the defenses were of two kinds. First of all, they played around with the word severe. The torture is the infliction of severe pain. That's when Jay Bybee, who was an assistant attorney general, wrote that memo in which he said, severe means equivalent to organ failure. In other words, right up to the point of death. The other thing was that they came up with the idea of intentionality. If a CIA interrogator tortured, but the aim was information, not pain, then he could say that he was not guilty. The third principle, which was crafted by John Yoo, was Guantanamo is not part of the United States. It is exempt from the writ of U.S. courts. Now, in the process of ratifying passing the McCain torture, the torture prohibition, the McCain's ban on inhumane treatment, the White House has cleverly twisted the legislation to reestablish these three key principles. In his signing statement on December 30th, President Bush said...
This was a statement that he signed as he signed the McCain so-called ban on torture.
Right. He emailed it at 8 o'clock at night from his ranch in Crawford on December 30th that he was signing this legislation into law. He said, you know, "I reserve the right as commander-in-chief and as head of the unitary executive to do what I need to do to defend America." Okay, that was the first thing. The next thing that happened is that McCain, as a compromise, inserted into the legislation a provision that if a CIA operative engages in inhumane treatment or torture, but believes that he or she was following a lawful order, then that's a defense. So they got the second principle, defense for CIA torturers. The third principle is that the White House had Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina amend McCain's amendment by inserting language into it saying that for the purposes of this act, the U.S. Navy base at Guantanamo Bay is not on U.S. territory. And last month...
10 seconds.
What's that?
10 seconds.
In the last month, the Bush administration has gone to federal courts and said, drop all your habeas corpus suits from Guantanamo. There are 160 of them. They've gone to the Supreme Court and say, drop your Guantanamo case. You know, they have, in fact, used that law to quash legal oversight of their actions.
We have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much, Professor Al McCoy, for speaking with us. Professor of History at University of Wisconsin-Madison, his book, A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. That does it for the show. Our website, democracynow.org. Our producers, Mike Berkshire, Fabdo Kadush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper. Very special wishes to Yoruba Richin on her trip, and Neil Shabata, happy birthday. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.